Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, February 15th, 2007. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. With this week, Adam Avery of Avery Brewing in Boulder, Colorado, joins us to talk about collaboration, the concept, and the beer. Adam is releasing a collaborative beer with Vinny Chalurzo of Russian River Brewing in Santa Rosa, California, and Adam gives us a peek behind the scenes of the brewing process. Well, I've got a little bad news and some good news. First, for fans of the International Mead Festival, I'd hoped to have coverage from our man in Colorado, Brian Warren, but, you know, sometimes real life gets in the way of things. So while we don't have sound from the festival itself, I'm hoping to be able to connect with one of the mead makers who attended sometime in the near future. The good news is that I'm heading to Kansas City this weekend to tour Boulevard Brewing Company and to get an interview there. Also, I've been invited to attend the 24th annual homebrew competition of the Kansas City Beer Meisters, so I hope to have some interesting sound from that as well. Our buddy John Palmer is going to be the featured speaker for that competition. I received a good response from our interview this past episode on organic brewing with Amelia Slayton of Seven Bridges Cooperative. Some of you say you're going to give organic brewing a try after hearing our chat with Amelia. I hope that you drop me a line and let me know how it turns out for you. Also, Amelia wrote me a note with a clarification. She says, when I was talking about some farmers being granted an EPA exemption to spray certain chemicals, it's conceivable that some folks listening might have mistakenly thought that an exemption was being granted to organic farmers, which is certainly not the case. Organic farmers are never allowed to spray harmful chemicals on their crops and still be able to label the crop organic. And Amelia says she came up with a better answer to my question, why brew organic? According to Amelia, it's to make really good beer that you can feel really good about. Makes sense. I appreciate Amelia's help. Along those lines, Jerry from Oak Creek, Wisconsin writes, once again, I've got to put in a plug for Lakefront Brewery in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Jerry says, in addition to the gluten-free beer produced here, Lakefront also has been producing its version of an organic beer, Organic ESB. So, sounds like Lakefront in Milwaukee is thinking out of the box a bit on more than one front. I appreciate that, Jerry. I received a bunch of email calling to my attention Bilk, the Japanese beer made out of milk. It's been all over the news lately, and I think we need to challenge our listeners in Japan to get some of this stuff, try it, and let us know what it's like. And as a bonus challenge, try to find out more information on how they make this stuff. I don't know. Beer milk. Doesn't sound very tasty to me, but I'll try anything just about once. You can make a cream stout with real cream, I guess. I don't know. Al from Poughkeepsie, New York, was the one who wrote a couple episodes ago that his homebrew store owner was discouraging the use of grain bags. Al writes back with an update. Al says, it was kind of surreal to hear my question read on the podcast last week. I was worried that I might be excommunicated from my local shop for questioning the tried and true methods. Well, we don't want that. Al says, I've been back to my local shop since asking the bag versus bagless question. In theory, when steeping with a bag, the grains at the center of the bag have a difficult time absorbing water. This issue is compounded when the amount of grain increases. Also, many folks use a wort bag as a grain bag, which allows too much grain debris into the wort. With bagless steeping, all the grain is in contact with the water during the steep. By straining the grains and re-pouring the tea through the grains, you serve to filter out any of the grain dust that may have made it into the kettle during your first pass. Al says this looks very close to what an all-grain brewer does during the mash and sparge. I used this method on a batch last week and it was pretty easy. I'll let you know if there's any difference in the finished product. Just another way to skin the cat, I suppose. Well, thanks, Al. As I say, I'm always open to different ways of doing things, so I look forward to hearing how your brew comes out. I'm pretty happy with the results of using the grain bag and the ease of use in an extract brew. So it would have to be pretty dramatic in the difference of the flavor to get me to knock my old habit. But, you know, I've got an open mind. I've got a few responses to the listeners who have written with olive off flavors in their beers. Casey, formerly of Asylum Springs, now in the UK, writes, I had a little bit of olive aroma in an oatmeal stout one time. I think in my case it was under pitching and slightly warmer than ideal fermentation temps, which gave the ester profile of a touch of olives. It was subtle enough not to be what I would call an off aroma, though not something I would shoot for on purpose either. And Casey says, for what it's worth, I was using White Labs Dry English Ale, WL007, licensed to brew, I guess, which seems prone to some unusual ester formation at higher temps. Appreciate that, Casey. Always good to hear from Casey. John from Hiram, Ohio writes, I brewed an olive-flavored Irish red ale a couple of years ago. I don't know what I did wrong, but in all my reading and listening, your February 8th podcast is the first time I've heard of anyone else brewing an olive-flavored beer. I couldn't fix my batch. I had to dump it out. It was undrinkable. Olive ale may be a good friend for Popeye, but it sucks to drink. I have to admit that, I came very close to making a Popeye joke when I first heard the olive-flavored beer, but, you know, I steered away at the last minute. It's good to hear that there's at least one other listener out there with a twisted sense of humor like mine. I appreciate that, John. And I'm going to read a part of a note from Robert in Auburn Hills, Michigan. Robert says, I can't explain the olive flavor, but it could be a sanitization problem or perhaps yeast autolysis. I had a problem with sanitation about a year ago with every batch I made having an off taste. I'd been brewing for over a year using plastic buckets. Robert says it started shortly after switching from bleach to Starsan. And as I said last time, this is me talking, that may be a red herring, so don't dump your Starsan. I researched this problem online and in books and asked my fellow brewers in my homebrew club. Finally, I held a Trumbull light in the bucket and noticed deep scratches. I believe yeast and bacteria can live in these scratches. That's what I've heard as well, too. I was told to scrap the buckets and buy new ones, but I wanted to test my theory. I bleached the buckets and hoses. Bleach is a powerful cleaner and sanitizer because it has the ability to break down organic material, Robert says. Most sanitizers cannot break down organics and cannot penetrate where bleach can. Robert says, after bleaching the buckets, I thoroughly rinsed them with tap water. Because tap water is not sterile, I have well water, I re-sanitized with Starsan and let it drip dry upside down. I've not had a sanitation problem since, and I never replaced the buckets. Well, thanks, Robert. Again, I don't think Starsan is the problem here, so don't. Lots of people love Starsan, so, you know, don't write me that I'm maligning Starsan at all. It was mentioned in the original email and this one, but don't make a connection saying Starsan gives you olive flavor. I don't think that at all. Robert goes on to mention in his email that a lot of brewers malign bleach, but he's had good luck with it. Now, coming up in the next few weeks, I'll have an interview with Merle Landman, a representative from National Chemicals. They are one of the manufacturers of iodophore, which is what I generally use. Merle has a lot of good information in that interview on using iodophore and on sanitization in general, so stay tuned for that. Norm from Ontario, Canada, writes, I heard your response to the question about lazy versus wicked boil and have to disagree with you. A vigorous boil merely means rolling. That is, the boil is enough to keep the hops and break moving in the pot. You really don't want more than that. If you read George Fix's Principles of Brewing Science, he notes that evaporation rates of more than 12% per hour can produce unwanted vegetal flavors and other sharp burnt flavors, unwanted except in certain specialized brews. On the other hand, the rule of thumb is to have at least 7% evaporation rate to drive off DMS and isomerize the hops. As little as 2% is needed to get hot break. I found that a 10% evaporation rate is a rather lazy boil where the wort is gently in motion in the kettle. You don't want the wort jumping. Well, I don't know that we disagree, Norm. It's hard to get a picture of what a lazy or wicked boil is. In my mind, I pictured a lazy boil as something with very little movement, you know, not like hardly anything happening in there at all. And a wicked boil as something on the other end of the spectrum, you know, one of those cauldrons you see at Yellowstone where it's just like throwing steam and water everywhere. So I'll stick to my previous fence standing position of saying the ideal is somewhere in between. you probably more toward the lazy side than the wicked side, but you do want some movement of the hops in there to get them working and all the stuff that needs to happen in the boil. So I appreciate the note, and it's interesting. I like you're having the figures in there of the evaporation rates to actually give us something to measure instead of just our interpretations of wicked and lazy. Now, on to our interview with Adam Avery of Avery Brewing. Adam is good friends with Vinny Chalurzo of Russian River, and when they discovered they both had beers with the same name, Salvation, they decided to collaborate instead of litigate. And we talked to Adam to get the story behind the scenes. Well, Adam Avery, welcome again to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me again. I can't believe you're actually wanting to talk to me once again, but hopefully it'll be better than last time, huh?
No, last time was good. We got good feedback from that. I think you've got a good energy. You know, you're making great beers, and, you know, you're really you and you know, Vinny and Sam and, you know, all the first names of, you know, the brewing rock stars are out there making it happen in craft brewing. So it's a pleasure to talk to you.
I don't know about the rock star status, but it's fun to talk brewing with people who like to brew. So and, you know, as far as those guys go, it's always fun hanging out with them. I don't think people realize how close-knit our industry is, and especially the little niche of the, you know, the extreme beer or whatever you want to call our niche of the brewer, of the industry is. But it's funny how well we all get along. Definitely no backstabbing or anything going like that, so it's pretty cool. It's like it's like a bunch of homebrewers getting together, just you know, drinking beers and talking about how to make beer. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, I did a couple of interviews with Maureen Ogle, who wrote a book on the American brew scene, you know, the history of American brewing. And she was talking about the German brewers, and when they first started out making it big in the country, competition was really ruthless, and they did just about whatever they could to compete against each other. And you guys, this is not the kind of approach that you're taking.
Not at all. I mean, we look at the pie. We're pretty smart guys. Well, I like to think that we're smart guys, but we look at a pie, and you're looking at, you know, American lager or lager styles, you know, representing, you know, 90% of sales, or probably a little bit less. And then you've got imports with their, you know, 10% market share or so, and then we've got our measly 3.5%. And you know, for us to bicker over the crumbs underneath, you know, Bud Miller and Coors tables is ridiculous. And so we realized that if we work together and hope to, you know, basically to get that tide rising so, you know, all our boats can float a little bit higher is the way to go. And, you know, we all have the same passion and drive, and so it only makes sense that we would become friends because we're also interested in the same thing, which is, you know, making, you know, unique, remarkable beers in a consistent fashion. And you know, that's what we're all dedicated to. So it's no wonder that, you know, there's certain groups of people that kind of fall in together. And you know, as far as working together goes, it's pretty easy. You know, we all do our own fests, and we all ask each other for beers, and you know, and obviously we do, you know, crazy things like go to Belgium together and those sorts of things. So you know, as the industry evolves, you know, so will the players, and you know, hopefully we'll get to go out and play more and have a good time.
So without Anheuser-Busch and the other big guys, do you think that you would be as collaborative?
If Anheuser-Busch wanted me to do a collaborative brew with them, would I be into that? Is that what you're asking?
No, I'm saying that you guys are collaborative. Kind of you're David's united against the Goliath.
Oh, yeah. Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. I mean, just think about it. Even if, you know, every percent that we take of the beer pie is monstrous volume, you know, for everybody involved in the micro industry. So, you know, when we have our, you know, craft brewers conference, and, you know, like a Kim Jordan from New Belgium, you know, her whole speech was about how do we get to, you know, 10% of the market, you know, how do we get to 20% of the market? So, if, you know, speaking on such small terms, you know, how do we all work together? You know, small breweries like myself, big breweries like New Belgium or Sierra Nevada, you know, how do we, you know, tie all our energies together in order to, you know, to take a bigger chunk of the market? And, you know, not just to take a bigger chunk of the market so that, you know, we can be, you know, all rich and wildly successful, but I think it's more about the education of the American palate. And, you know, because I think most of the people that are still in business today doing what we do are in it for the passion and for, you know, the creation of, you know, whatever you want to call it, art or science or, you know, a combination of both. But we're really into, you know, showing people what we think beer is supposed to be. And we think that people have been brainwashed for so long into thinking, you know, to borrow Greg Cook from Stone Brewing Company's motto, you know, yellow fizzy beer, you know, that is what beer is. You know, it's an educational process. And so it's really cool how a brewery like mine can really, you know, reap the benefits of somebody like a New Belgium, because without New Belgium, you know, without their Fat Tire, or, you know, without a Sam Adams Boston Lager, we're not, they're pulling, you know, Bud Miller Coors drinkers into, you know, our industry. And then some of those people are going to get a little bit more adventurous. Their taste buds are going to be like, hey, we want a little bit of something else. And then, you know, that's where breweries like, you know, Dogfish or Avery or Stone or Victory, you know, that's where those guys come into play. You know, that's where we come into play. So, yeah, hopefully we'll all continue to work together for the greater good, which is to educate people into understanding that, hey, beer should taste, you know, very, very complex. It should have a bunch of different layers to it, and it shouldn't just be carbonated, you know, yellow water, basically.
Now, what do you think of the efforts of the big breweries to start getting into the crafty-ish type beers?
Oh, I love it. I think it's great. I mean, the one thing that I know is that if people drink my beer, I really have a hard time believing that a very large percentage of those people are drinking Budweiser, Miller, or Coors products, if ever. But what I think what they're going to be doing is they're going to be taking people who are normally used to drinking Bud Miller Coors, and then they're going to start putting out products that are more like ours, and they're basically going to be teaching their consumer that, you know, hey, this is what beer should taste like, and then boom, that opens up a whole new world, you know, for this beer drinker. And then, you know, Avery Brewing Company is a part of that. And as you know, especially with homebrewers, is that people aren't super brewery loyal. You know, they're basically industry loyal. They're loyal to a niche, you know, that microbrewing niche. And so I'm not so worried about, like, trying to create, you know, like Avery-driven drinkers. You know, what we need to make sure is that people are looking for more flavor in their beer. And so what Bud is doing with all of their products is that's what they're doing. They're making a little bit bigger beers, something that's a little bit more aggressive. And I think that really, I think it plays right into, you know, our hands. Hopefully, you know, Augie Bush isn't listening to this. But, and I have a feeling he's not, so I think we're safe.
You never know. You know, there's maybe some junior member of their marketing team is listening to the beer podcasts out there and the homebrew podcast. Well, you were talking about collaboration, and that is the name of a beer that is coming out under your label.
Correct.
And we talked about it a bit when we were actually out there at your brewery. But give us the background again on this collaboration, not litigation ale.
Okay, yeah, sure. Great, fun project that kind of speaks volumes to, you know, where our industry is as far as, you know, people coming together and helping each other instead of, you know, worrying about, you know, copyrights and stuff. So anyway, Vinny Scirlizzo of Russian River fame became a really good friend of mine, you know, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. And we soon realized that we, you know, both had a salvation beer in our lineup. So mine is Salve. It's a golden ale, very hoppy, crisp, and very fruity flavor. His Salvation is more it's a dark strong ale, like a double-ish kind of flavor beer, more malty. Anyway, we both realized that we had these beers in our lineups, and we were like, should we worry about who had the name first? Should one of us, give up the name rights? And we both were like, hell no, we like what each other's doing. We're like, let's just keep doing the way we're doing it, and you'll have your Salvation, I'll have my Salvation. Well, there was a little thing thrown in there. We should sometimes think about, doing a blend of the beers. So anyway, I think in April 2004, I finally went out and visited Vinny and his wife Natalie at Russian River Brewing in Santa Rosa, California. Went to their brew pub, and immediately, obviously, had several pints of Pliny the Elder, which is one of my all-time favorite IPAs. I think probably some of the people out there have had it. Then we got to the task of blending these, his Salvation and my Salvation. I brought some bottles, and he pulled some out. So we came up with this really good blend of the two. And, so this was, almost 3 years ago. About 6 months ago, I opened my mouth to a reporter for, I believe it was a New Brewer magazine, and she wrote an article about the beer, which has never been made. So the article comes out, and I give Vinny a call, and I said, Vinny, did you see the article? And he's like, yeah. And I go, it sounds like we have to do this. Well, this is at a time when my growth rate's like 40%. His is like off the charts. And, we have, very little space for, brewing all this stuff. And we're just like, oh, man, how are we going to make this happen? Anyway, we clear some time at our brewery, some tank time for this little collaboration. Vinny, for federal reasons about, how to blend beers and stuff, we thought it'd be easier to make all of the beer here at Avery Brewing Company, and then the taxes could be paid and all that sort of thing, and keep Uncle Sam happy. So Vinny flew out here and brewed his beer here at the brewery. We brought in, he sent us his recipe, and it was like all these malts that we don't use, so we had to go and bring in all these specialty malts and his yeast strain, and so he brewed his beer, we brewed mine, and we did a blending in December, and then we packaged in January of this year. So it is out on the market, and I'm pretty sure the beer for Northwest Arkansas is on the way, too.
And, that's the most important part of the conversation for
me. Well, I knew that was going to be the next question. It's really, and I got to say that it's one of the best beers I think that we've ever made here. And Vinny, I just shipped him a pallet of beer so that he can have it at his brew pub, and he said the same thing. We're really amazed at how well it turned out. And the cool thing about it is that while you can pick up hints of my Salvation and hints of his Salvation, the blend of the two is a completely different beer. I mean, it's wonderful how both beers married together and created something different, and not only different, but Vinny and I both agree that it is a better beer than either one of the Salvations.
Hmm.
The complexity is unbelievable. The drinkability at 9% is unreal. It's a great beer, and we only made one batch, and we made 700 cases or something. So it's not a big marketing ploy, but and we're not going to make a lot of money off of it. But the money that we do make off of it, we are going to take Sam from Dogfish, Rob Todd from Allagash, and Tommy Arthur from Port Brewing. We're all going to go back to Belgium off of the profits and under the guise of a return educational trip. It's just a chance for all us guys to get back together like we did last year at this time when we went to Belgium. So it's going to be pretty fun.
So it's all for the betterment of brewing.
Well, truly it is. I mean, because we found out a lot of stuff while we were over in Belgium about their traditional brewing techniques. And, and I think we can definitely apply some of them here. I mean, they're definitely, I don't agree with all of them, but definitely opened my eyes to, how they do things, spontaneous fermentation and that sort of thing, and how they do their barrel aging. Highly educational trip and things, and definitely things that we've incorporated here into the brewery. On a small scale, nothing that's gone out, but... It was definitely a great trip.
Now, talk about the similarities. His is more of a double, and yours is more of a golden.
Yep.
Talk about the similarities. They're both Belgians, so they come sort of from the same family. But talk about the similarities in the flavors and some of the contrasts and how they did come together.
Well, I think, I mean, for me, obviously they're Belgian, so a lot of people say, well, it's pretty similar. But I think they're really pretty dissimilar beers. You know, his yeast strain is like got a maybe a mustier, more I don't know how else to say, like a yeast, like a yeastier note, more traditional Belgian flavors. Ours is a Belgian yeast strain as well, but it throws off a lot of fruity, like apricotty kind of flavors, and some spicy phenols as well. So the yeast strains are, you know, really different. His malt bill is completely different than, you know, what ours is. I mean, our malt bill is very simple, and his is, you know, quite complex as far as the dark malts go. And, you know, he has very little hops in his, while ours is, you know, we use as much hops in our kettle as we do with our IPA.
Wow.
So it's, you know, our Salvation is a very hop-driven, spicy beer, and his is, you know, definitely is more reliant on those weird specialty malts that he puts in there, and, you know, gives it that really, you know, Merritt Suish 8 style, you know, pretty thick, you know, robust, almost chocolatey kind of malt flavors.
Wow. So was it a 50-50 mix or what?
No, it's definitely, it's not a 50-50. It's close to that, but we're going to keep that secret for a while.
Okay. So get a bottle of each at home and play with it and see if you...
It's funny, people are doing it too. You know, we people, you know, on Rate Beer, we see some cool rates on there, and then people call us and, you know, they're asking us questions about it, and we're like, you tell us, you know, that's what I want to know. I want to see what, you know, people who are going to drink this beer are going to be homebrewers or, you know, beer geeks extraordinaire just like I am, you know, people who know beer. So I don't want to give it all away. I want to see what people think, because I think it's going to be hard for people to tell, you know, what is that blend. And I think a lot of people are going to have trouble realizing that it's, if you took a bottle of our Salvation and a bottle of his and you drank each of them and then you drank the collaboration, you'd wonder how it came to collaboration, because it really isn't just, you know, A plus B equals C. There's definitely something else that happened in there, and that's the weird side of our business, is who knows how those flavors are going to marry up once you put them together.
As Charlie Papazian says, you're getting a little woo-woo-y.
Mm-hmm. We woo-wooed on this one, yeah.
Well, as you mentioned, you know, we're the beer geek factor. We are beer geeks, so I can't let you you know, go too much further without peeling back the covers a little bit and showing, you know, telling us what went on in the brew session. You say that Vinny has a different approach with his grain bill. You know, tell us as much as you can what went into these beers.
Well, you know, I don't feel it's my place to talk about, you know, Vinny's recipe. I'm pretty open with most people about my recipes, but I'm not sure how he is with his. I would just say that we brought in, I don't know, 6 malts that we had never used before.
Hmm.
In our brewery. So it was fun to, you know, mash in with those and to taste those different malts. And we're actually going to incorporate at least a couple of those into our anniversary beer this year. So, you know, it's definitely a cool learning experience for Avery Brewing Company, having Vinny come in and, you know, and see how he does, how he brews his beer. And then, you know, obviously the Salvation for us was, you know, that was easy because we've been making that beer for, you know, whatever, 6 years or something. So, you know, nothing crazy going on there. I mean, I can share, you know, our Salvation recipe, but hopefully you understand that.
Yeah, I completely understand.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So tell us about yours.
Well, I mean, you know, Salvation is pretty, I think it's fairly easy beer to make. You know, the malt bill is relatively simple. A couple of, you know, light specialty grains, you know, some Cara 45, some Cara 15, you know, obviously lots of two row. We use some light Belgian candy sugar and some turbinado sugar as well, to get our gravity to where we want it. And then, you know, we don't have a lot of IBUs on that beer. We have, 23 IBUs, which, you know, isn't a lot. It's kind of high for a Belgian beer, but not a lot. But you know, the cool thing about Salvation is that we, the yeast strain that we use, which is 3787, that's what we use in Reverend as well. It's the Westmalle yeast strain. If you ferment it, you know, at pretty high temperatures, you get a lot of great fruity esters, and that's what I really like about Salvation is that I really get a lot of apricot and peach on the nose, along with some cinnamon as well. So, you know, you got some spicy phenols going on there. But the really cool thing about Salvation, like I had said before, was that we hop the living shit out of it. You know, as far as a Belgian beer goes, we use well over a pound per barrel in the kettle to finish off. So it's not a dry hopped beer per se, but at the end of boil, you know, we're dropping massive amounts of Styrian Goldings into the brew. And so you do get, you know, a big, you know, hop nose off of it. So
you're using lots of hops, but not getting a lot of IBUs at that point.
No, I mean, most of the first editions are Styrian Goldings as well, so and it's a low alpha rating. So, yeah, we're only building about 23 IBUs. And then, you know, that last edition, we're still getting some IBUs, obviously, because you've got some heat in there, so you're getting some conversion. But, yeah, we've got to calculate it out at 23 IBUs. And, you know, super hoppy. But the thing is that, you know, as homebrewers know, it's like, you know, if you have a yeast strain that doesn't contribute a lot of flavor to a beer or nose, you know, that amount of hops would be like, ooh, IPA. But because this yeast strain, 3787, is throwing off so much aromatics as well, there's really a battle between, you know, those esters and phenols and the, you know, the final hop addition. So it may not seem as hoppy as the amount that we're using, but, you know, in order to taste that amount of hops, we have to use that amount of hops because of, you know, what we're doing as far as, you know, higher fermentation temperatures and things to really accelerate the ester development.
And when we were out there, you were talking about starting off at fairly low fermentation temperatures, and then once you get going, just let nature take its course.
Yeah, well, I mean, what we found with anything high gravity, you know, meaning, you know, 8% up to, you know, whatever, 18%, whatever we've done, is that if we can start off at a lower temperature, we typically have a lower fusel alcohol development. And the yeast strain itself is a little bit healthier. You know, a lot of people think that trying to get fermentation over with fast is a good idea, which is probably a good idea with lower strength beers, and it's fine. But when you start doing super high gravity beers, if you're stressing your yeast cells where you have a small amount of yeast, you know, taking in a lot of sugar and producing a lot of alcohol, a lot of times they can't expel the alcohol as fast as they're producing it. So they're basically killing themselves off. So if you reduce that temperature in the beginning, you're making fermentation last a lot longer, but these yeast cells are able to, you know, expel the alcohol out of their cells a lot easier. And it keeps them healthier for a longer period of time, which kind of goes against, you know, what a lot of people would say, which is, well, then they're living in an alcohol environment for a longer period of time, and you're asking them to live longer and to produce more alcohol later on. But that's a lot better than to be, you know, basically, you know, having the toxins inside the cell. It's a lot better to have those toxins on the outside of the cell because, you know, there's other things you can do as far as feeding the yeast and things, you know, to keep them healthy throughout that, you know, that term of fermentation. So, yeah, so we'll start fermentation for the first 2 days at about 66 degrees on Salvation, and then we'll let the temperature come all the way up. And usually by the end of fermentation, we're in, like, mid to high 70s.
So still not way high.
No.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of discussion and seen a lot of discussion from homebrewers who say, I like to do Belgians in the summer because, you know, I like to ferment, you know, in the 80s for my Belgians.
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely works. I mean, we go up to 80 degrees, like on our Karma, which is our Belgian pale ale, which is, you know, our 5% summer seasonal. And we use a Rochefort yeast strain for that. And it really develops this really cool fruity, you know, fruitiness to it at higher temperatures. So, yeah, we're all over the board. And, you know, on some of our monster beers, like Mephistopheles and the Beast, at the end of fermentation, it could be, you know, in the mid-80s by the time we're done.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what about on your Salvation, what about the mash temps? You do a single infusion mash, right?
Yeah, and we're right in that, like, 150 to 152 area. We're trying to ferment as much as we can out of it. We want a pretty bone dry kind of flavored beer. You know, we're trying to take away any kind of residual sweetness. Obviously, there's going to be some sweetness in the beer, but we want to get it to be a really drinkable, dry golden ale, more sessionable, you know, than something that you just want to, have as a sipper.
So does Vinny have a similar philosophy on mash temps on his salvation as well?
On Vinny's, yeah, because his actually finishes about the same gravity as well. So we're at the same mash point, about 150, 151.
Wow. Well, that's I'm looking forward to tasting it.
I've been drinking a lot of it. I mean, to be honest with you, it's way better than I would have thought it would have been. I mean, we did that blending, you know, way back in 2004, and we were all like, "Oh, this is really good. This is great." But you know, something else happened here at the brewery, and you know, it just came together so nicely. It's really good.
Well, while I've got you on the phone, I told you I was going to ask you about this.
Okay.
One of my standard beers that when I go to the liquor store is to pick up White Rascal, which is a Belgian wit beer, right?
Yep.
And so, you know, I've got to ask you, what's behind the White Rascal?
Well, you know, I love Belgian beers, and we make a lot of, you know, super high alcohol Belgian beers. And, you know, a few years ago, I decided we needed to make a wit. I mean, I'm a big Hoegaarden fan, and I just like the style. It's just such a fun beer to sit down and drink a bunch of, and it's a light beer, but it's got so much flavor. It's a great beer for, I mean, beer geeks love the style, and then I've also got people who say they don't like beer, and you're like, well, I don't think they're going to like this because, you know, it's got coriander and orange peel in it, and they end up loving it, you know, and it's a ton of flavor, just not a ton of body, and, you know, it's a style that I like. So when we went after it, when I decided to make one, obviously, I was going to do it the way that I do most beers, which is to be a little bit on the big side for the style. And so, you know, we definitely use more coriander, more orange peel than I would say that most wits have. So, you know, it's spicier, lots more, you know, citrus floating around in it. Mash bill is pretty simple. You know, most wits are, you know, 50-50 or someplace in that between two-row and malted wheat. We use Dingemans malted wheat. We really like that. So, and then our two-row is our base two-row that we use for all of our beers. We use, we use the Hoegaarden yeast strain. I don't have the number in front of me. Sorry for not having that, but I could come up with that.
A Google search would probably.
Yeah, and I definitely recommend using it. We ferment that from day one at 72 degrees. And, you know, the one thing you'll find is that it doesn't want to flock. The yeast doesn't want to flock very much. So you may have a little extra time in secondary trying to get it to clear up, or at least clear up to where you want it to be. Like if, for a wit beer, we try to get to about 8 million cells per milliliter in a bottle or less, just so there's a good dusting of the yeast at the bottom. So when you do the little swirl at the end, you get that real nice cloud effect.
So if you theoretically wanted to harvest the yeast strain, you could get a White Rascal and try that.
Oh yeah, for sure. If you could pipette the bottom of a bottle, I would chill it, take it home, chill it, and then, you know, and grow that up. I definitely think you could get some good results, especially if the beer were on the fresh side. But we use Sterling hops for bittering, and we use Czech Saaz and Sterling combination for the end of boil. Obviously, it's not a hop-driven beer. I mean, it's one of our least hoppiest beers that we make. The aroma is definitely, you know, dominated by the yeast strain and by the coriander and the orange peel. So we grind our own coriander here, so we buy it in bulk, and we have a special grinder that's set aside just for that because it's a really pungent seed. And then we use a blend of two different kinds of orange peels on it. We use a Curacao orange peel, which is the traditional. It's more of a bitter orange peel. And then we also use a sweet orange peel as well in there. And what we did was we constructed I guess you could just call it like a T-ball. I mean, it's this huge I don't know, it's probably like 3 feet around, and it's built out of stainless steel. It's got stainless steel meshing around it, and then the top is bolted on, pull that off, throw all the coriander, all the orange peel in it, and then we have a pulley system rigged up above our kettle that we can drop that into the kettle once the boil is done. We shut our boil off, and we're starting to whirlpool the hops out. Then we'll set this T-ball in there, and we'll let it steep in there for 30 minutes, and then we'll run off into our fermenter from there.
Oh, wow. So it's at the end of the boil where the spices and the orange peel comes in.
Yep, yep. That's plenty enough because, I mean, with those flavors, the coriander and the orange peel, I think if you boiled them, you would drive all of the flavor off. You know, your orange peel is basically an oil, you know, so just like with hops, if you boil it, you're going to drive off the aromatics, right, and create bitterness. And, you know, the same could be, you know, could be true about, you know, orange oil. I don't know. I don't know if there's any kind of, you know, bittering unit if you would boil it, but we just make it like tea, and that way we know that we have we can maximize the aromatics and the flavor right there in the kettle, you know, in that 30 minutes.
And one thing that I like about the beer is the mouthfeel. It's creamy, you know, without being too heavy. You know, it's a great summer beer because it's so, you know, relatively light in gravity compared to some of your other beers.
Yeah, I mean, it's, it's like 5.5%, and, you know, that is our lowest finishing gravity beer. Finishes at, 10.08, I believe. Starts at 10.48. And so, yeah, it's, you know, it's definitely our, quote, lightest, you know, in body beer for sure. But not in flavor by any means. You know,
no.
I think there's tons of flavor there, and I think we hit the just the right amount of yeast in suspension so that you do get that nice, you know, kind of, you know, creamy, full mouthfeel.
Yeah, well, it's a wonderful beer.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it.
And we look forward to – is there any other beer that you're working on that's coming up? You said an anniversary ale was coming up.
Well, yeah. I just decided actually a couple of weeks ago, or actually just last week, what our anniversary beer will be. So it's, you know, it's called 14, so we've had 10, 11, 12, 13, and so – 14 is going to be the description is going to be a different dark dry hopped ale, and for lack of better description, it will be a super rich Belgian double that we are going to dry hop the crap out of. And so it's going to be, I don't know how you would describe it, but it's a beer that I've been wanting to make for a long time because I really enjoy the malt flavors of a really good double, but I really wanted to see, you know, we're going to use tons of East Kent Goldings. We just got in on the fresh last year's harvest of the EKGs, and so it's not going to be super hoppy like our Maharaja is going to be, you know, piney and grapefruity and stuff, but it's going to be in that real traditional English sense, but we're going to use a ton of dry hops. So I'm excited about this beer. Like, I think, and it's going to be probably in the 9% category, so it's not going to be super alcoholic, but it's definitely going to be, it's going to have legs so that, you know, it can be, you know, laid down. And we are going to, and it's going to be unfiltered. So, you know, everything will stay in the bottle. So, huge experiment. I think it's one that, you know, like I said, I've been dying to make a beer like this for a while. So, here we go. It's going to be number 14. It'll be available, we're shooting for May 1st as a release date.
Is there a better job in the world than what you've got?
I wish I was a professional basketball player, but that didn't really pan out. So I'm going to take, second place would be to own a brewery and to be able to have a homebrew system that just happens to be a 40-barrel homebrew system with 240-barrel carboys. And I can brew whatever I want as long as I can get my distributors to and my fans to sign on to buy enough to keep us in business, which is what it's all about. You know, it's a fine line between the beers that I want to make and the beers that I think can actually sell. So some people think that I go over that line some days, but so far so good. Things are working out.
Well, I know you're busy, and I certainly appreciate your time.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me, and good brewing to everybody out there. And again, if anybody's going to be making some clones of these beers and they feel like sending a sample out to me, I'd gladly give her a taste for you.
All right. Thanks, Adam.
All right.
Well, it's fun to talk to Adam. I'm still looking forward to finding and trying Collaboration Not Litigation Ale. And sounds like an excuse for a get-together. Next week, I hope to have some sound from Kansas City. It may just be the sound of me celebrating getting off the shingles medication that's been keeping me away from homebrew for the past couple of weeks. I don't know. But hopefully there'll be some useful stuff coming out of there. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com. Or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. And while you're on our site, you can check out our online shop, where you can find great pricing on our DVDs and a combo deal to save you even more. In Basic Brewing Introduction to Extract Home Brewing, we walk you through the extract brewing process step by step, from boiling to bottling, all points in between. And in Basic Brewing Stepping into All Grain, we take you through the all-grain process, from milling your grain to collecting your wort. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com, and if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online from us, and we'll send it to you ourselves, actually myself. Also, be sure to look for our new Brewer's Logbook. As of this recording time, I have 3 copies left. So, maybe sold out by the time you get to it. I don't know. I appreciate everybody who's picked one of those up. And appreciate all the comments I'm getting back, too. And thanks to everybody who's continuing to click on our Amazon.com link, despite my, having fun with things that are bought. We appreciate your support. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Rich Dad, Poor Dad, What the Rich Teach Their Kids About Money That the Poor and Middle Class Do Not, and the Fellows DS1 Fashion Shredder with Step Can. Thanks again, everybody, for doing that. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries about, me making fun of you personally. And a note to the listener who purchased the Bluetooth-enabled GPS system. Trevor in Reading, Pennsylvania, says thieves in England are using cell phones to detect those things, and then they break into the cars and steal them. So, check your Bluetooth settings on your GPS thingy, or turn it off when you're not using it. You're parked somewhere. I don't know. Something else to worry about, I guess. And you're welcome for that for that extra worry. That's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by our buddy Kelly Dotson in Austin, who did our logo as well. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.